Hello, everybody. My name is Karen, and I am an alcoholic. So it's really an honor to be here today and to share my story with you. I'm going to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Because I'm an alcoholic, I don't like to start at the beginning. I like to start in the middle. And the middle is my show and tell. It's my plastic ambulance. So those of you who have heard me share my story before, you may have seen this. This is what I put on my AA birthday cake every year. It's a reminder of the day that my life began to change. That was December 19th, 2002, when I took a ride in an ambulance to a Paris hospital called the Hôpital Cochin. And once I got there, I hovered between life and death for 48 hours. I was in and out of a coma. They called my family to come rushing over, telling my family that I was dying. I went into severe alcohol withdrawal once I was there at the hospital. I had DTs. I had several epileptic seizures. It was really a very bad scene. The underlying issue was acute pancreatitis, super acute pancreatitis, which was starting to shut down all of my vital organs. The underlying issue of that, of course, was chronic severe alcohol abuse. So some people get sober after thinking long and hard and deciding that it's time for them to change. They would like a new way of life. That is not what happened for me, okay? I had to drink myself to this close to death before I was ready to change. And that ride in the ambulance certainly got my attention, and I hope it got yours. So now I'm going to go back to what it was like. I was raised in a small town in Illinois, which is in the very center of the United States. I did very well in school as a kid. I attended quite a fancy college and did pretty well in college. I had not started daily drinking when I was in college. I got a very flashy job in New York City just out of college. But then on my 25th birthday, I up and moved to Paris, which was something that I had dreamed of doing since I was a little kid. Somehow or other, I wrangled my way into a job, quite a good job, in an industry that I was very passionate about. So, you know, it was kind of like the I had arrived phase of my trajectory, as Bill describes it in his story. I seemed to be reasonably successful on the outside, but pretty much as long as I can remember, I had felt a lot of pain on the inside. I don't know how many of you felt that way. I was raised in a very nice middle American community, a very nice family. There was a lot of alcohol and a lot of abnormal drinking, I can now see, in my family. We were also Illinois Germans. I don't know if anybody knows what that means, but we were, you know, quite staunch, stiff upper lip kind of people. There was not a lot of talk about feelings and that kind of stuff. You know, it was quite a sort of strict environment. One way or another, ever since I was a really little kid, I always felt that I wasn't validated, that I wasn't loved the way I needed to be loved. I pretty much just felt like things were not okay. Just basically not okay. And then especially like that I was not okay. You know, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And in other words, I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. Pretty much decided when I was a little kid that I was on my own, you know, that I had to go it alone. I've since then learned that a lot of us make that kind of decision in childhood that we're really going to have to go it alone. And I recognize today that that over-reliance on self is something that is deep at the heart of my disease of alcoholism. And it's one of the things that keeps me separated from other humans and keeps me separated from God. So in my teens, I discovered alcohol, as many of us did, and I discovered that alcohol could make that pain go away, at least temporarily. So that certainly got my attention. And in my early 20s, after I left college, drinking very much became a daily habit for me. That was something I saw a lot of when I was growing up, so that did not seem strange at all. Alcohol brought me ease and comfort. In other words, alcohol brought me relief, and alcohol worked for me, as you hear people saying in the rooms. It made me feel relaxed. It made me feel like I was could be creative, that I could talk to other people, which was not something that came that naturally to me. It made that lonely over-reliance on self somehow a little bit more tolerable. But slowly over the 20-odd years that I drank every single day, alcohol slowly but inexorably just completely took over my life. I lost my values, I lost my moral compass, I lost my connection to others and my connection to God, and I lost any sense of who I really was, I mean, to the extent that I had that sense. Physically, I became a trembling wreck. I was one of those people who became very physically dependent on the drug of alcohol, so, you know, when I woke up, I won't say in the morning, because, you know, morning was not something that I saw much of, but when I woke up, I really needed a drink to function, even to do the simplest tasks. And, you know, I got to that place where I lied. I had to lie, because otherwise I couldn't make sense of, like, you know, where I had been when I was supposed to be at work. I engaged in pretty elaborate strategies to get the drinks that I needed, and then I lied to cover my tracks and to cover how much I was actually drinking, how I was living. At some level, I knew I had a problem, but, you know, I just got in the habit of sort of pretending to others and pretending to myself that everything was fine. And I know now that I was in that vicious cycle, you know, where I was drinking to cope with the effects of my own drinking. My life was unmanageable because of the way I was drinking, and the only thing I could think of to do about it was to drink more. So, you know, that's a cycle that only goes in one direction, downwards. And for me, it ended with the ambulance. So when I came to in the hospital, I was in the intensive care unit. I was very confused, dazed, and confused. One of the first things I remember is my sister, who is from the non-drinking or anti-drinking faction of our family, leaning over my bed. She's like right in my face, and she says, "The doctor says you can never drink again." Thank heavens that during the epileptic seizures, I had bit my tongue open on both sides. I could not speak, okay? So thankfully, I could not tell her where to get off, because I think that would not have been a pretty thing. As I gradually came to, I just felt so bereft, so alone. And the reason for that is that I had lost my best friend, right? My best friend was alcohol. And it was like my best friend had turned on me, tried to kill me, and could no longer be my friend. And that was just a really lonely, horrible place to be. I was in the hospital for a whole month. At one point, there was a very earnest young intern who had clearly had the course in medical school about addictions. And he came to me and he said, "Madame, you must mourn the loss of alcohol." That was about the first thing I heard that made any sense to me at all. And I was like, he's right. So I asked for a pad of paper and I started making a list. My idea was I would list all the things about alcohol that I loved and that I was going to miss. So it was quite a long list. I don't remember now exactly what was on there, but it was things like alcohol helps me relax, alcohol helps me to be creative, alcohol helps me to be with other people and have fun, alcohol helps me to think deep thoughts, all of those kinds of things. And then I was going to make a list of the things that I would not miss about alcohol. And honestly, I could not think of one thing. I was in a hospital. I couldn't even think of hangovers. And I had always had horrible hangovers. But I was so focused on how much I was going to miss alcohol that I could not see how, you know, what alcohol had done to me. I was so focused on what alcohol had done for me, or what I thought alcohol had done for me. And I tried to keep that memory fresh in my mind, because I realized that there is so much denial just built into our very disease. And that's one of the things that makes it very dangerous. So when I was released from the hospital, I was terrified that I was going to drink again. The only thing I could think of to do was to call my therapist, who I'd been going to for a couple of years. And I trusted this therapist. It's quite ironic. I trusted her because she had never told me to stop drinking, right? She'd never called me on my drinking. I had never told her how much I was drinking, of course. But, like, I'm pretty sure if that she had called me on it, or, like, told me to stop drinking the way some therapists do, I would have just quit therapy. You know, there's no way I was going to stop drinking just on her say-so. But when I got there, I explained to her where I was at. I came clean about how much I had been drinking. And she said, "Well, why don't you go to AA? And I said, "Why would I do that?" I absolutely did not want to go. And she said, "Well, you know, nobody really wants to go, but many people do find it quite useful." And I was like, You know, it really did not occur to me. And she said, you know, just go. You don't have to give your real name. You can sit in the back. You won't have to say anything. And just give it a try. And I was like, because I trusted that therapist, I was like, okay, I'll give it a try. So I went along to a meeting. I have very clear memories of that meeting. The speaker at that meeting is in the room today. Hey, Tim. He was celebrating 16 years. And so he now has 38. Yay, Tim. And I remember this really cool guy who's like telling this great story, and he's younger than me, and he has 16 years sober. I was like, what? I mean, that really blew my mind. It was a great meeting. The minute I stepped across the threshold, I felt like I was at home. I liked the people. I liked the vibe. I felt very comfortable. It was wonderful. One thing did happen that I was not prepared for, which was that the secretary, John C., did call on me. So my therapist had lied, but that's okay, and said, would our newcomer like to say anything? And I was like, oh no. But what came out of my mouth was, well, I'm not here to stop drinking, because I had to stop drinking by spending a whole month in the hospital, but I guess what I'm here for is some sense of hope that there can be life without alcohol. And I'm really grateful today that John called on me, because that word of hope was exactly what I needed, but I hadn't said that to myself. And that's something that I can really hang on to today. And I'm pretty sure that almost every time I go to an AA meeting, I do get a sense of renewed hope. And I think that's one of the most important things that we find in these rooms. And, you know, there aren't that many places in this world where you're pretty much guaranteed that you're going to get a sense of hope. So I'm very grateful for that about our rooms. And as dazed as I was that first day, I definitely got the message that it wasn't like, you can never drink again, but more like, one day at a time, you don't have to drink again, you know, just keep coming back. And that was exactly what I needed to hear. And so I did keep coming back, and I'm pretty certain that those early meetings literally saved my life. In those early days, I did wake up in the morning, thanking God that I was alive. I was conscious that I had had a very close scrape. I was grateful to have those meetings as a safe place to go to where I was pretty sure I would feel okay and feel some hope. I was very grateful that nobody gave me orders or advice or tried to tell me what to do. I just don't think that I was ready for that or open to that. And the obsession to drink, the compulsion to drink, were lifted from me. I was very much carried by the grace of God in those early days. And, you know, all of those things are miracles, and I did keep coming back. So to move on to what it's like now, I'd like to talk about the changes that have occurred between the way I saw the program of AA in those early days and the way I see them and try to live them in my life now. So in terms of the program, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So as I just said, when I arrived in the rooms, I really loved the stories, I loved the laughter, I loved the sense of hope. But when I looked at that poster up on the wall of the steps, that made no sense to me whatsoever, right? It might as well have been written in Chinese. I mean, to the extent that I could understand them, I was like, who would ever do that? I mean, it just sounded so scary to me. And I really couldn't understand, even though I was hearing people share and talk about their program and everything, like, I could not understand how those 12 things, what that had to do with being able to not drink anymore. I just didn't get it. I was very, very dazed and confused. So those early days, I stayed sober a lot on fear. Also, just the energy in the rooms, and I know mostly I stayed sober on the grace of God. When I was in about 6 months, I decided I better get a sponsor, not because I wanted a sponsor or that I wanted to work the steps, but I kind of felt embarrassed that, like, I couldn't really keep coming around to meetings if I didn't get a sponsor, that I was going to be drummed out of the core. And I knew I needed the meetings to stay alive, so I thought, well, I better get a sponsor. So I did. My first sponsor was wonderful. She did all the right things, but I was just not really ready. I did not have the willingness. We read the big book together. She helped me to do step one, helped me to do step two. Step three, she asked me to choose a special place where, you know, we could sort of have a step three moment. So I chose this island in the sand that has always been kind of my sacred space. We went out there. We said the third step together, the third step prayer together. And then I had this visualization. I visualized taking all of the icky mess that was in my head and in my heart and in my soul and throwing it into the San River. And that it was going to be washed away by God, and that everything was going to be fine. I was quite proud of myself, actually, for coming up with that. But, you know, after I did that step three, It dawned on me that it was then time to do step four, and I did not want to do step four. I was really quite resistant. I know that now that I was just very afraid of doing step four, and so I bumped along, kept going to meetings, but I like stopped calling that sponsor. I wouldn't even go to meetings where I thought she was going to be there because she would remind me that I needed to do step four, and I did not want to be reminded of that. So I bumped along, and then when I was just about 2 years sober, a little more than 2 years sober, the bottom fell out of my world. I lost my job, which was very much a very important thing in my life. So I heard once that if you stop drinking and your life gets a lot better, that probably means you have a problem and you might be an alcoholic. If you stop drinking and your life gets a lot worse, that probably means you're a real alcoholic. Because it means that alcohol was your way to function. And all of a sudden, you've lost that. And I think that I was very much in that category. When I was in my first years of sobriety, my physical health got a lot better. I mean, it could barely get worse. But my mental and spiritual health did not improve and probably deteriorated because I had lost my solution for being able to feel calm and think deep thoughts, right? So I was full of fear. I was haunted by the wreckage of my life. And I was a little bit more awake and conscious so I could see just what a mess my life actually was. You know, all the bad decisions, bad choices I had made. And when I lost that job, it just kind of felt like the world was ending. I was in a lot of pain, but I couldn't drink to make that pain go away. So that was a very bad place to be in. So I think I needed that pain to become more teachable, to find some willingness. And I call that moment my second bottom or my spiritual bottom. You've probably heard people talking about this kind of experience. There was a big turning point that came at that time when, thankfully, a wise alcoholic had me read one particular paragraph in the big book that has always stuck with me on page 52 that's called The Bedevilments, and I'm going to read it for you. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. So this person asked me, "Does that sound like you?" And I was like, "Yes, that's about it." And they said, "Well, bad news, you are suffering from alcoholism." And I said, "Wait a minute, I haven't had a drink in 2.5 years. And they said, "Yes, you're suffering from alcoholism." And it took me a minute to understand what they were on about. And they said, "Yes, and unless you do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're probably going to stay in that very same place, whether you drink or not, and you're probably going to drink again." So that was a big moment for me to like finally understand what those steps were for, because I really didn't get that when I was starting out. And so I was suggested that I start over at step one, which I did. And, you know, the first time I did step one, that little ride in the ambulance had been so dramatic that I didn't really pause to try to understand what exactly was wrong with me. And it was, and I, the things that I thought about step one were like, "Boy, did I mess up. I have really made a horrible mess of my life, and okay, I surrender." And the subtext of that in my mind was, you know, "I have brought shame upon myself and my family, and I am a disgrace." And when I reworked step one, after having had this spiritual bottom, I actually took the time to read more about alcoholism, to read the doctor's opinion with help from experienced people who knew how to get at the truth in these sometimes difficult texts. And I understood at last that I had a disease, okay, that was a physical disease, but also a mental disease, a spiritual disease, and an emotional disease. And I finally got it that I was not a bad person, I was a sick person, okay, with a disease that a lot of people also shared. And that was really important for me to understand. And to this day, every time I rework step one, I get new insights on just what that disease is. And most importantly, I get compassion for myself, but also for all of the people who share this disease. Step two back in the day was, "Well, I've always believed in God, no problem here, let's move on." And that's not at all the way I see step two today. I did have a belief in God that I'd had since childhood, but I think I was pretty blocked from God, actually, by my disease. After my second bottom, I had another look at step two, and I've been looking at it a lot in between. And I realize now that it's not that we have to believe in anything, but we have to believe that something bigger than us can heal what's wrong with us. And I finally understood that the something that I needed to get better was the 12 steps of AA and a higher power that actually helped me via those 12 steps. As I heard in the step two workshop yesterday, it's a lot to do with trust in the process of recovery that could make me better. And, you know, when I was little, my God lived way up in the clouds. Today, my God lives mostly in the rooms of AA. And I must say that I feel that God most in the times that I spend working with others. So I already told you about my first step three. Today I see step three in a pretty different way. For one thing, I see it operating on several planes at once. You know, I think that step three we can do every day and several times a day. I usually try to start my day with a step three prayer. And often, sometimes during the day, I also use that prayer as a way to just like let go and let God come into my life. But I see step three mainly as a crucial part of the series of 1 to 12 that gets us better. And it gets us better if we work them in order according to the directions. It's like step three for me is like we stood at the turning point part. And to me, it means I make a decision to work the program of AA. I make a decision to work for and all the rest to the best of my ability and to let my higher power transform me and transform my life. Now, as for step four, I've already told you that as a trembling newcomer, I saw step four as something like, oh, I am such a disgrace. And now I have to sit down and write down and look at just how bad my life was, just how badly I have managed my life and all of the bad things I have done. It's not a big surprise that I did not feel like working step four, if that's what I thought it was. As I said, I hadn't really grasped that I was a sick person and not a bad person. And so, of course, I couldn't look at my life. I was blocked by a lot of shame. After I reworked 1, 2, and 3, I was finally able to do a step four. It was quite thorough. I can't say that it was fearless. It was not fearless. It was very fearful. But at least I did it. And I have completed the steps 4 through 12 several times now with different sponsors who have all been wonderful and wise and patient. I have to say that I still struggle with step four. For me, it's a hard one. And I can say that like today, as of February 2025, that seems to be shifting. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit. One important thing that has happened is that I decided with the support of my sponsor to get some professional help, specifically with the issues of trauma and shame. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is that I think that there are probably many of us in the rooms of AA that have issues like this. And working the steps is important, but it's also important to get help with underlying issues that we may have and to address the trauma that may be present in our lives. For me, there's some family trauma. There is some sexual violence that I have never really dealt with. And I know now about trauma that it can almost automatically generate shame. We tend to blame ourselves for the bad things that have happened to us. And that makes it really hard for us to look at ourselves. And so I have accepted that if I get some professional help with these shame issues, that's going to make it easier for me to actually unlock the power of the steps and specifically the problems that I've had doing step four. And I wish I had addressed these issues years ago, but I didn't. And I'm glad that I am doing it now. In the step four that I'm working at right now, I have also been looking at the language in the big book. I mean, I love the big book. I feel that that is very much our basic text that tells us how to work the program. But I also find that some of the language in the big book is not ideal for me. It reflects the socioeconomic milieu of the people who wrote the book. You know, Bill W. and his merry band of 1930s stockbrokers who were all guys, you know, they talked in a way that is not necessarily the way that I think as a 21st century woman. And they talk a lot about how, you know, we need to be deflated, that we're stuffed shirts that need to be brought down to size. I feel that a lot of us maybe have been pretty deflated already by life and by our disease. And maybe what we need to get right-sized is to be encouraged and built up. all the talk about anger and combativeness and resentment as anger that needs to be looked at in step four, not something I really relate to. You know, my hurts don't come out as anger. My hurts come out in different ways. And I try to remember that resentment means re-feeling old hurts, ressentir, and that for me, it's important to look at those old hurts and the ways that they have impacted my life. And through doing these two kinds of work, I think that step four is really shifting for me right now, and I'm very grateful for that. So what is step four like right now, or more like what is it becoming? It is becoming simply, who am I? You know, looking around for things that I don't need anymore, like some of those old hurts that I've been dragging around for 50 plus years, getting ready to let go of those. And I've heard people say that before, it never really sunk in. And now, instead of a fearless and thorough moral inventory, I'm trying to think of my step four as a patient and compassionate exploration. It means the same thing, but it feels different. And the question I'm asking myself is, who am I? What have I been through? And what is blocking me from God and from my true self? So with honesty and compassion, as I'm doing this current step four, I can see that I am a flawed and broken person, but I'm also a worthy and lovable child of God, the child of a God that wants the best for me. And as I grow in humility, I spend less time worrying about the fact that I am so bad. And that's very old thinking. It doesn't serve anybody. I try to remember that in step seven, I give all of me, good and bad, to my higher power and ask that God help me to be useful. And that means helping others rather than sitting around focusing on how bad I am. But it's taken me some years to be able to get to that place. I can also see that although I still have lots of work to do, that today I am actually happy. In fact, today I am even joyous. And today I am actually free. And how cool is that? You know, the promises are coming true in my life. So I'm going to stop at step four because that's where I am today. I'm not going to have time to tell you, you know, my latest revelations about 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I'm pretty sure that, you know, these are all of it's a work in progress. In a couple of years, all the things I'm saying today will be in the what it was like column. And there might be new things that'll come in to take their place. That's one of the cool things about the 12 steps in our program is that they tend to morph and grow as we grow. I do see the 12 steps taken together as a simple kit of spiritual tools, as it says in the big book, and that they were laid at my feet by those who came before us. For me, they're a series of numbered actions that I do in order according to the instructions in the big book, and that allows me to be transformed by something greater than myself. Each step practiced individually can bring relief, you know, and after all, we are relief junkies. We want something that'll make us feel better. So, you know, just doing prayer meditation can make us feel better. Just surrendering can make us feel better. Just talking to another person can make us feel better. But I feel that it's working them in order that really brings about the magic, and that each one opens the door in a unique way for what's to come next. I heard recently in a meeting that the 12 steps are not a menu, they're a recipe. I love that. I'm a big believer that it is a recipe and you have to do the things in order. It's not going to come out very well. If you try to put on the frosting before you've put in the eggs and the flour, it's not going to be a very good cake. And I do think that each step does open the door for the next one. When they say, you've probably heard before, don't quit before the miracle happens. To me, that doesn't just mean keep coming back, you know, for the newest of newcomers. To me, it also means keep working the steps. And if you finish them, start over and work them again until not just one, but many miracles happen, because that's what does happen. If I had quit working the steps when I was just 2.5 years sober, I'm sure I would have shortchanged myself in a big way, and I'm pretty sure I would not even be here today. So when I was a newcomer, one day at a time, what I needed was a safe space. I needed laughter. I needed to hear stories. I needed hope. As time went on, I needed to make mistakes. I needed to find my own way. I needed to run into some brick walls and to find my willingness. And usually for me, willingness only comes after a certain amount of suffering. I needed to let God do what God does. And today I need that more than ever. Just the same way that I needed every single drink I took to make my way into that ambulance on the way to change, I also feel that I have needed every single crazy iteration of the steps that have taken place in my head and in the ways that they have appeared to me and as they've morphed over time, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, sometimes scary, sometimes baffling. But, you know, those steps have appeared more and more to be rich and multi-layered and luminous. So I've heard working the steps over and over compared to a spiral staircase. You're going over the same ground, but you're seeing it from a different height and a different perspective. I think that view is a very good one. And today I see that that spiral staircase leads me from the place of the bedevilments that I mentioned earlier to the place of the promises that we all know from page 83. It's almost a one-to-one correspondence between the bedevilments and the promises. And instead of fear, we begin to know serenity and peace. Where we were unable to cope with life, we instinctively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And above all, we see that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. So today, as I pause on that spiral staircase to look down and share my story with you, the thing I see most and most clearly is that the whole time, even though I don't recognize it in the moment, I have been carried by the grace of God. That grace is something that I experience through all of you and through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you for keeping me sober, and thank you for letting me share.